All right, we're going to get going here. Hello and welcome to High Gravity Brewing, Pro Techniques for the Homebrewer. My name's Chris Hummert, and I'm your representative on the American Homebrewers Association Governing Committee. Before we get started, please take your seats and move towards the center of the aisles. That way we can make room for any late comers. Make sure to turn off or silence your cell phones to avoid any disturbances during the presentation. We will be taking questions at the end of the session using the standing microphone that you see in the center of the room here. We ask that you come up to the microphone and ask your question so that it is recorded and everybody can hear it. Before I get started, I want to quickly remind you that as an American Homebrewers Association member, you have access to over 450 recordings of seminars just like this one on homebrewersassociation.org. Recordings from HomebrewCon 2020 will be published later this year. Follow the QR code behind me to access the seminar archive page. Finally, at the end of this session, please make sure to submit session feedback survey. There's a short two-question survey associated with each educational center or session at the HomebrewCon 2020 mobile application. You can find the fill out the survey button at the app below in the session description. Your feedback will help the Brewers Association and the HBC Seminar Committee continue to provide better homebrewing education in the future. Now, before we begin, I'd like to briefly introduce our speakers today. We have James Saar. He is the Director of Sales and Marketing at Grainworks Brewery Company in Westchester, Ohio, and a member of the Master Brewers Association of Americas. And we have Brittany Frey, who is the Production Manager at Mad Tree Brewing Company in Cincinnati, Ohio, and a certified Cicerone. Thank you all, and enjoy your session.
Take it away.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you. So, like we said, we're James and Brittany. This is Brittany. She not only is a production manager at Mad Tree, but she also used to be a brewer there, and she still occasionally brews there. And previously, she was a brewer at Swine City Brewing in Cincinnati.
This is James. As we stated, he is the Director of Sales and Marketing in Grainworks. If you don't know your Ohio geography, Westchester, Ohio is between Cincinnati and Dayton. Before Grainworks, he was over at Urban Artifact as a brewer, and then he was before that a brand ambassador at Fatheads in Cleveland, Ohio. So James and I met when we both decided to go back to school and study brewing at Cincinnati State for their brewing science program. But really, our friendship blossomed while we worked on a side project while we were there together as students. We joined into a local homebrewing contest as part of their Bockfest celebration.
And us and our significant others who are in the back and don't want me to embarrass them, but they're already on the screen, so you might as well raise your hands. The four of us are all really good friends and like to travel together and do fun stuff.
All right, so some of you already have some of the beer that we have brought for you today, so we'll just give you a little background on each of those. We have three. The first one is a rye Weizenbock that we brewed at Mad Tree. This beer was made by our lead brewer, Ryan Johnston. It is named Skipping Moose. We like to challenge our lady who draws the tap boards and try to give her some interesting things to draw for us. So if you make your way to Cincinnati, it is available in our tap room right now.
So I am not part of the production team at Grainworks. I'm in sales and marketing, so I don't really get to brew there, except every now and then when we have special projects, or every now and then if we're going to collaborate with another brewery and somebody on the production staff is not available, they might send me out. But we did a really cool project. Every year our sales team gets together and does a brew, and we then use that to give to our clients as a thank you gift for the end of the year to our buyers who are buying our beer at bars and restaurants and retail locations. And this year we did a barley wine, and we're calling it This One's on Us.
So 2 years ago, this presentation was going to be at the Nashville Homebrew Con. So since then, James and I don't really homebrew as much anymore because our jobs are very demanding time-wise. And unfortunately, the last thing I really want to do when I get home is brew beer. So the third beer that you have today is an Imperial Stout. that my husband Adam brewed for us, and James and I wrote the recipe for.
And within our group, because we don't really have a lot of time to homebrew, Adam kind of continues to be the very regular homebrewer of our group, and I will put him up against any professional brewer I know. He's great at what he does, so I think you're going to really enjoy that Imperial Stout. But Brittany and I are usually just happy to sit back and chill and watch Adam brew, and occasionally we help him clean up.
Yeah, he likes when we join the homebrew days because he has a cleanup crew. He doesn't have to do it all.
So, and one other thing, if you like the Grainworks beer, we will also be serving Grainworks at the Grainworks booth at the kickoff parties in just after this. So, hopefully today you're going to come away with some very useful info and techniques, including learning how to increase brew house efficiency and your lautering efficiency, some advanced efficiency techniques, a better understanding of the various production issues you'll have with high gravity brewing, and some adaptations that will help you in getting high gravity brewing right.
So let's first define what high gravity beer means. That typically means that it's a recipe that's built with a wort that finishes at 8 degrees Plato. So to put that in specific gravity terms, 8 degrees Plato is 1.074 for your starting gravity. And that will likely result in a beer for you that is 8% ABV or higher.
If you notice that Brittany mentioned Plato, so you're going to hear Plato a number of times during this presentation when we are quantifying gravity or discussing different recipe aspects.
So typically in professional brewing, we use Plato as our standard of measurement. It's just mostly just easier in cases when we're talking about that with each other on the floor.
Like a really simple example is the first thing you see up there. So 10-degree Plato wort contains 10 grams of extract per 100 grams of wort. So it's easy to use that to build calculations into other things. Also notice that we're using metric because that's also a standard as well.
So if you break that down a little bit more, that just means that 1 degree is Plato. Approximately will give you about 0.44% ABV. So 12 degrees Plato will give you about a 5% ABV finished beer, depending on your attenuation.
Right. So we're going to, of course, recommend that you consider using Plato for your recipes and your data collection. At the same time, though, if it doesn't work for you, that's fine. It's just you're going to find some of the advanced calculations out there work a lot better if you understand Plato. You don't have to end up with a bunch of extra conversions. And it's what the professionals do. So if you want to talk to brewing professionals, they're going to speak in Plato and they're going to speak in metric. So you can learn a lot more information, wouldn't you say, when you're talking to professionals?
Yes.
So speaking of scientific things, I want to just take a quick moment to talk about the scientific method, because this is an advanced course, and you're not going to get a lot out of your brewing if you're not using the scientific method. It's one of the things in school that Brittany and I learned really applied to brewing science just as much as any other science discipline. But what do I mean by scientific method in terms of how it relates to brewing? Well, first of all, you want to observe your outcomes, and if you need to test to gather additional data, then do so. You need to record those outcomes, and you need to analyze that data that you're getting, and then you want to refine your process from the analysis of the data you've done. And you want to keep doing this until your results are repeatable. Because in brewing, specifically in professional brewing, repeatable results are the most important thing.
All right, so the first section we'll get into for high gravity brewing is increasing your brew house efficiency. We're specifically going to hit on the lautering efficiency.
Okay. Now, how are we going to improve that efficiency? We want to talk about decreasing your batch size or using an oversized mash tun and also double mashing. These are three ways that we can improve that efficiency and that we're going to get into.
So the first section, decreasing your batch size, that is going to be the simplest method for getting that high gravity beer that you're aiming for. So some of the advantages for decreasing it is it's going to be the simplest method. It's also going to be your least costly because you're not buying extra equipment, and you're also not purchasing extra ingredients. And this actually is the most common method for most commercial brewers. So therefore, a lot of data is already out there for you to gain from them, as well as your homebrew clubs. So with every advantage is a disadvantage. So with decreasing your batch size, you actually are going to end up with a smaller volume overall. So that means less finished beer, which who wants that? Your boil-off rate is going to remain the same. Just because you have less wort in your boil kettle does not mean it's going to operate differently. So it will actually concentrate faster. So you want to make sure that you have your boil rate dialed in for that increased gravity. You also need to make sure that you know what the maximum capacity is of your mash lauter tun. Even though you are going to be decreasing the batch size to get up to that higher gravity wort, you do need more, at least base malt. So you don't want to make sure that you're overstuffing it.
So the next method is using an oversized mash tun. But before we get into that, I want to talk a little bit about Darcy's Law. Again, I geek out on the science end of things, so I always grab the slides that are sciencey and geeky. Darcy's Law is an equation that describes the flow of a fluid through a porous medium. And in brewing, we use Darcy's Law to calculate the flow rate of your lauter. So in simplest terms, the lower the height of your mash, the greater the flow you're going to get. So therefore, the best mash and lauter tuns are short and wide, not tall and narrow. Okay? So here in this slide, you're going to see a professional brewing system at a brewery that had already planned from the very beginning to do high-gravity brews. And so they built their brewery and their brew deck around an oversized mash tun. This larger mash tun allows more room for grain for the exact same size batch that you would fill that brew kettle. And you're not maxing out your mash tun. It gives you a lot more freedom there. So you can do this for yourself. For instance, if you had a 10-gallon boil kettle, you could, say, get a 15-gallon mash tun, and then that would give you the room to do this. The advantage of this is that you're going to have more surface area, which, as we explained, is better efficiency because of Darcy's Law. It's also going to be easier to mix that mash and get it more evenly soaked if it's wider. And then that reduced mash height is going to be very important with these high-gravity recipes because you're going to have a lot more grain, and therefore the potential of having a stuck mash is greater because your grain bed could collapse under all that weight, especially once it's been wetted down. So that is going to be one of the most important factors. Now, of course, there are always disadvantages. Full disclosure, and you guys have probably seen the brew-built system, because I believe they have that exact system down there on the expo floor. I'm using it in this picture just for a visual example for you to see what an oversized system would look like in theory, but that actually is a Herms-based system, so that's actually the HLT that's oversized. But I just want you to get an idea of visually what that would look like. And yes, you could feasibly put, say, a 10-gallon boil kettle and then have a 15-gallon mash tun on a lot of different brew sculptures. But I didn't want anyone to be like, hey, I saw that system downstairs, and that's not what it was. So, but yeah, I just gives you a little visual example. But so what are these disadvantages that I'm talking about? Well, of course, it's more expensive because you've got to buy another mash tun or you have extra equipment with the mash tun. You might have to custom order it, or it might be a custom build if you're building your own, if you build your equipment out of used kegs, things like that. And you have to have the consideration of what space you have in your brewing area or on your brew sculpture. Can you fit this larger mash tun? And lastly, make sure it's not too big. Don't say, well, oh, I'm going to do a ton of these things. I'm going to make this really big. I want to make some really, really big beers, because you could get in a situation, I think at Mad Tree, they have something similar to this because they have a pretty oversized mash tun, and there are certain low-gravity beers that they've got to do double batches with in order for the grain to fully cover the false bottom. So am I correct on that? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. So another technique would be to double mash. This actually does mean that you will then have two mashes, no sparge, and then you're going to combine all of that wort into the boil kettle. If you do decide to go this route, these are the steps that we recommend. So you're going to mash and lauter that first batch, and you're going to collect only your first runnings, so that really good high sugar content. And then you don't want to sparge that at all. Then you're just going to grain out that first batch, and then you're going to repeat that again. So kind of like a wash, don't rinse, and then repeat. That is one of the methods. But if you go down this route, you want to make sure that when you mash out or you lauter the first time, that that batch hits your target temperature into the brew kettle. And then you want to keep it at that temperature while you are mashing your second batch. You want to make sure that you keep that temperature up in that range because you don't want to risk continuous enzyme conversion. And then also, if you don't do that, then you could end up over attenuating your wort.
And end up with a dry beer.
So some of the pros for double mashing: you are going to have a full boil kettle of high gravity wort. Mm-hmm. So that means you can produce a full size batch. So as one of the techniques we talked about earlier, with lowering your size, then you will have more beer. So at Mad Tree, as James kind of alluded to earlier, we do have a very wide and narrow mash tun. So we have run into the issue with some of our low-gravity beers. We have a Session IPA and our American Light Lager. The first time we brewed those, we realized that we had holes in our grain bed, and just basically when we were sparging, there's straight water going down into the false bottom. So we have to combine the double mashing at the same time. So we basically make a high-gravity lager. Then when we knock it out into the fermenter, then we have to dilute it with RO water just to get to our desired starting gravity for that beer. So make sure if you do any of these techniques that you consider every possibility and know your equipment before you go steam forward ahead.
That's
still me. Sorry. So some of the disadvantages for double mashing is it does take a lot longer. Basically, that's going to be like a double brew day. So you want to make sure that you account for that time. You will need more grain, so that's going to up the expense a little bit. Less than buying more equipment, obviously, but still an extra cost. And you are going to end up with less extract at the end because that two batches of grain that you didn't sparge has a lot of sugar left over.
So as we were doing this presentation, we got talking, and I kind of had a little light bulb go off. And I was thinking, what if you could, when you're done with that first batch, you've grained out, and you're about to put in that second set of grain, when you get done with that second set, don't throw either of those two away. What if you put those aside? So then you have a nice high gravity thing, and then go ahead and put them back together. So while the high gravity one is boiling, maybe you could mash out, throw in a little extra grain if needed, or between the two of those, get second runnings from both of those. Maybe you could use this as a partagile. However, I'm not going to get deep into partagile because tomorrow, in this very same room at 145, you can check out Party Like It's 1099 and 1045, which is done by Roxanne, Mark, and Andy, who are friends of ours who are in the same homebrew club as us, the Bloterian Brewing League. And please check our club booth out on Friday. So let's move on to some advanced techniques that will allow you to get better at the high gravity stuff and solve some more advanced problems. Oh, it's still me. Hey, so how are we going to do this? There's going to be three things we're going to talk about. So longer boil times, adjuncts in the boil kettle, and then also using adjuncts in the fermenter.
So one of the easiest ways would be to have a longer boil time. I'm sure most of you have practiced this. But that does concentrate your wort. You can go for a 90-minute boil or longer. You could really concentrate it down as much as you want. I would recommend, though, to make sure you're considering the color and taste effect that that would have on your wort, because the Maillard effect is real. And then most of the software that you will use to build your recipes will allow you to adjust and calculate for longer boil times. So just make sure that you make those changes in your software program.
And if for whatever reason the software you use doesn't adjust for that, reach out to the software developer. I found that most of the developers on these pieces of software are very responsive, and that's the kind of thing that they love to hear. So, or, you know, if you're at an expo like this, go actually talk to them right at their booth and say, hey, make sure that feature is on there. I believe Beersmith does it, but I'm just saying if you use something else that doesn't, reach out to them. However, if you really want to get their attention, I guess you could cry on social media. That really would get their attention. They would love that. But really, seriously, if you just stop by their booth, I'm sure, you know, or if you reach out to them in the email, they're super responsive. I've always had great response from software developers in the brewing community.
So also when you're not reaching out to them, if you already have that built in, just make sure you know what your boil-off rate is so you are boiling accurately. And then always double-check that with manual calculations. If you need to have those, we do have a PDF file attached to our seminar for you afterwards.
So we're not going to go into real big detail. This is so you can have this afterwards. But to just give you an idea, this is a very simple set of calculations that will help you determine your evaporation rate. It's pretty self-explanatory. But what I would recommend is going home before you brew again, and just do a boil with water, but, you know, measure your substances, take note of all your data, and again, track those changes and analyze, and you can use these and figure out what your evaporation rate is. And then you have that moving forward, so you can plug that in, your boil-off rate, you can plug that into the software, and then you have it correct moving forward. But also note, especially if you're a gas brewer, you want to make sure you know what that gas setting is, or electric brewer. You want to make sure you know what that heat setting is, because if it changes from batch to batch, that may change your boil-off rate if you're applying a heck of a lot more heat. So if you can control that and make that a data point, make sure you know what that is.
So another technique that we wanted to discuss was adding adjuncts into your boil kettle. We recommend to add adjuncts in the boil kettle and not the mash tun, because the boil kettle will sterilize it, and it's going to create a more homogeneous wort for your whirlpool. Also, you want to make sure that you don't use more than 8% of adjuncts in your total recipe. If you do more than that, that's too excessive, and you can provide your yeast insufficient nutrients. which we all know yeast is the powerhouse and creates the beer for us. So let's give them the best possible wort that they can. One of the last but very important things is when you, excuse me, I'm reading my notes. One last very important thing is that adjuncts you use must be at a higher gravity than the starting pre-boil gravity. Otherwise, if you add it as a lower gravity than your wort, you are actually diluting it, and so you're decreasing your gravity, which is not what you're going for. Also, just note that these are common adjuncts. Make sure that whichever one you choose, it has the sensory aspects that you want for your ending beer. They do add flavor, aroma, color, and do change the attenuation rate.
So in addition to using them in the boil kettle, you could throw them right in the fermenter. And now, if you're going to do that, you need to make sure that your ingredients that you're putting directly in the fermenter must be sterile, or you must sterilize them to prevent infections. So you could do that by boiling and then cooling it right before you pitch it. Or you could use sterile ingredients. A prime example, there was one of the vendors down in the expo hall I saw was doing aseptically packaged fruit purees, which there are a lot of different adjuncts that you could add that are aseptically packaged, so you know you're not infected when you put them in. You just want to be very careful about the process of doing it, so in opening up your fermenter, you're not introducing anything. Or, hey, you could use non-sterile ingredients and just hope, because, you know, that works. We've all done that once or twice, but and if you don't care about it ending up being a sour beer later, then maybe why not? But in addition to this, you want to remember that you're going to need more extra oxygen for this bigger beer, and we're going to get into the oxygen later. And then also, one of the advantages and the reason, I mean, because we could say, hey, you could throw extra adjuncts in the fermenter, but the possibility of infection could be an issue. Do we want to leave this out? But I wanted to put this in because we're going to talk a lot about yeast stress in the next section. And one of the beauties of adding it, if you're adding it in the later part of the fermentation, after a lot of the sugar has been eaten by the yeast, so it's already been processed, and then you add more sugar in the form of these adjuncts, that's going to help you reduce hyperosmotic stress. Don't be afraid. I'm going to explain all that in a second. So
that's also just lactose in that bag there.
Oh, yes. That's I promise. That's just lactose. Yep. Absolutely.
So let's move on and talk about issues that you're going to experience during high-gravity brewing and how you can problem-solve those.
Your issues, that the three most common ones you're going to come up with are yeast stress, ethanol tolerance issues, and, like I said, insufficient oxygen.
So yeast stress. Many of you have experienced yeast stress. I'm sure, I know I'm one of them, where a lot of times I will try to stress out my yeast for specific types of beers. But for high-gravity brewing, we're going to go a different route with that. We're going to be kind of more hitting on the severe stress that can be detrimental to your yeast and can cause a number of very serious issues. So first of all, the standard pitching rate, just so we're on the same page for higher-gravity beers. The standard pitching rate just for mid-gravity to low-gravity ales is 1 million cells per milliliter per degree Plato. At this pitching rate, you can basically guarantee that you're going to ferment that beer without any issue on the lower and middle-gravity beers. But for higher gravity, we want to hit around 1.25 to 1.5 million cells per milliliter per degree Plato. If you pitch a higher gravity beer at the standard lower rate, you could basically just give your beer insufficient cells, and that could put the yeast under a lot of stress and will negatively react to the beer. That will create some off flavors and some other just really crappy stuff you don't want. So the three main sources of yeast stress that most brewers come across is actually excessive amounts of sugar, insufficient oxygen, and ethanol toxicity. If you do have some stressed yeast, you could determine that by some off flavors that you could find in your beer. Mainly yeast-derived off flavors are diacetyl, fusels, and acetaldehyde. Diacetyl, I'm sure you guys have all smelled that before, hopefully not in your own beers, is an off flavor that typically has that buttery, fake popcorn butter, or at high levels, some people can get butterscotch. Through my sensory training, I have found out I'm one of the weird people that gets Campbell's tomato soup, like just straight out of the can, opened it, and it's diacetyl. But also in larger amounts, you can get that really slick mouthfeel that just like gets back on the back of your teeth there. So diacetyl is naturally released by yeast. And then typically if it's a healthy fermentation, the yeast will reabsorb it. That's why we do a diacetyl rest. But if your yeast is too stressed, that diacetyl rest may not actually work for you.
We mentioned fusels earlier. Well, yeast produce a diversity of alcohol. The alcohol that is not ethanol is termed higher alcohols or fusel alcohols or just fusels. And they are any one of a number of 45 different alcohols that are produced in addition to ethanol. In high-gravity brewing, these are largely unavoidable. Though if you excessively stress your yeast, you're going to create more than is generally acceptable. So it's acceptable that you're going to have some fusels, a little bit of that booziness, a little bit of that alcohol aroma and flavor, but you want to avoid pushing it. In smaller amounts where you want to be, you're going to have a little bit of a warming effect, that aroma, that sensation. In larger amounts, it could go past the point of just being unpleasant and get you into solvent-like characteristics. Think paint thinner or nail polish remover. And fusels are also thought to be responsible for hangovers, although I found it's just from drinking way too much. Fusels can also be created by too much oxygen in the wort and too much zinc in the wort. And take note of that because we're going to talk about adding oxygen and zinc later.
Last but not least, for off flavors you can get from stressed yeast is acetaldehyde. So acetaldehyde has that flavor and aroma of that green apple, apple skins, or water-based paint.
Water-based paint. Okay, I got to cut it because I love this. So MadTree does an amazing sensory program both internally and externally. So if you come to the brewery, you can actually take the sensory class. The same thing they use to train the employees, but the public can do it. It is super fun. And Becca, who used to run it, one of the things when she was trying to help people understand, like, you know, if they couldn't get the green apple, she would say water-based paint, and people would say, I don't get that. And she's like, you know, like when you walk into Home Depot, and it became, so the Home Depot that's right by MadTree, right as you walk in, is the paint section. And so it became colloquially known at their brewery as the Home Depot smell. So it's like, yeah, oh, acetaldehyde. Oh, I got the Home Depot. And I just think that was just so hilarious. So it's one of those things that we've now carried around and told other people, and our brewer are like, oh, I got a little Home Depot.
Yeah, it's a nice little Saturday going to Home Depot and smelling acetaldehyde. So acetaldehyde is also naturally created by yeast. It's the precursor for ethanol. So if it's a healthy fermentation, the yeast will process the acetaldehyde into ethanol. But extreme yeast stress can prevent full fermentation, hence why you have that acetaldehyde left over.
Okay, now for the big scary science words. So, but wait, there's more. Before we get into hyperosmotic stress, let's start by taking you guys back to high school chemistry, because there's a couple terms I want to make sure we're all on the same page with. We want to first start by talking about the differentiation between solutes and solvents. So a solute is a substance that dissolves in a solvent. Super simple. For instance, sugar is a solute, and we dissolve it into water. Okay? So sugar is a solute dissolved into water, a solvent to make wort. There you go. Super simple. Now, let's define osmosis using those terms. So osmosis is a process by which molecules of a solvent tend to pass through a semi-permeable membrane from a less concentrated solution to a more concentrated solution on the other side, thus equalizing the concentration on each side of the membrane. And hopefully that image gives you a better idea. So we're not talking about bringing the solutes over. We're talking about actually pulling the solution over so that you have an equalization of the amount of solutes, an equilibrium on both sides of that membrane. Now, why is that important for what we're talking about? Well, yeast cells have a semi-permeable membrane around them. That's their outer membrane. And they will try to reach equilibrium with the wort, okay? And so that means they are going to absorb both solutes because it's very, actually, very permeable. So they're actually going to pull in some solutes that they're going to eat. But they will also be expelling water, okay? So that can lead to desiccation. And also, I need you to remember, before we fully nail hyperosmotic stress, let's talk about what yeast can eat, okay? Yeast cannot eat all sugars, okay? That's why we have highly attenuated beers and also bigger-bodied beers. Yeast can only eat 6-carbon hexose sugars. Don't worry about that. Just remember it's glucose, fructose, sucrose, maltose, galactose, and maltotriose. Okay, and maltotriose is only in the case of lager yeast. All the other sugars that they will encounter are unfermentable, like that lactose I was holding. I promise it was lactose in that picture. They can't eat that, okay? However, when we're talking about yeast stress, we have to consider all of those solutes that are suspended in that solution. Because together, even if they're not consumable by the yeast, they're going to lend to that stress. Remember I mentioned adding adjuncts later after some of the sugar has been eaten and turned into alcohol? Well, that would be one of the things there. You've now lowering that amount of solutes, so you can add a little more in later, thereby avoiding that hyperosmotic stress, okay? So what is hyperosmotic stress going to do for you? Well, it's going to dry out your cells, desiccate them, okay? As those cells try to reach an equilibrium with their surroundings, okay? So why is that a bad thing? Well, it's going to lead to two things. It's going to lead to necrosis, which is trauma-induced cell death. Crazy description, but that trauma is in response to an overwhelming chemical or physical insult. I love that science term, physical insult. Actually, when learning about necrosis and hyperosmotic stress, was the first time I ever saw that, and I just love physical insult. I just love that that's a very specific science term. Apoptosis is just your typical cell life cycle or genetically programmed death. So why would the stress have to do with that? I mean, the cell's going to die eventually anyways. Well, we don't want to speed that up. We don't want to accelerate that life cycle. That stress will cause that as well. So it could cause it to have trauma and die early, and it could cause it just to speed up its lifetime because it's being desiccated. In addition to generally poorer yeast health and performance, we also need to be concerned with autolysis. And autolysis is when the cell ruptures and expels nasty stuff that you don't want. So no matter how those cells die, whether they die naturally in their life cycle in apoptosis or in necrosis, early death from trauma, they could leak undesirable substances that are already in them, or fermentation byproducts that can cause off flavors or bad aromas in your beer. And you don't want that.
All right. Ethanol tolerance. So when you're looking at your yeast packets that you decide to use for your beer, make sure you're looking at the manufacturer's suggested parameters regarding your ethanol tolerance for that specific strain. You can find that typically on their websites or even on their packaging. What we do recommend is that you trust the manufacturer that you are using their product from, and also make sure that you're pitching healthy yeast within their suggested date code. All of that information can be found on the package. Make sure that you are pitching the correct amount as well, using that calculations that we talked about earlier for your higher gravity beers. But also, we just want you to make a note that typically for ales, you can push past a little bit from the manufacturer's description. Most ale yeast can handle up to 10% ABV. Obviously, make sure that it's healthy and viable yeast and within the date code of the manufacturers before you go down that path. And then, obviously, just make sure that you're picking the right style of yeast for the beer. So you don't want a Hefeweizen yeast in your Imperial Stout. So as you can see here, we have a Fermentis SO4 packet up here for you, which is a pretty popular brand between all brewers alike. You can see here that they listed the different temperature ranges. So they have the shorter range and its optimum range. So the ethanol tolerance is closely tied to these temperature ranges. Ethanol does become more toxic to yeast growth and viability, yeast viability, at a higher temperature. So when the ethanol also decreases your yeast optimum fermentation temperatures, and it decreases your yeast maximum fermentation temperatures. It's a lot of information. So basically, the higher gravity of your beer, the lower that you want those temperatures to be during your fermentation. As you can see here, we have the optimum temperature for yeast, for the yeast growth. So your optimum temperature for yeast is indicative to your yeast ethanol tolerance. So remember, your manufacturers will share that with you. Higher gravity beers do ferment better at lower temperatures, and it is suggested to start at the low point of the overall temperature range. And then you're going to slowly step it up over a couple of days during your active fermentation. Make sure that you don't exceed the highest temperature of your optimal range from your manufacturer's recommendations, and never go up higher than the highest temperature of the overall range. The advantages of this is that you can prevent yeast stress that we've been talking about for the past couple of minutes, and you have that high yeast fatality rate. But some of the disadvantages, obviously, it's going to take a little bit longer time in your fermenter, maybe a day or so. So just remember what we have posted up here. This is your yeast self-growth curve. So within the first 40 hours or more, your yeast is still going to be consuming that oxygen that you gave it. And it's creating biomass, or it's reproducing. It won't be fermenting until all the oxygen is gone out of your wort. So don't raise that temperature until your actual fermentation is taking place. So a little fun experiment that we did at Mad Tree that I wouldn't be able to talk about 2 years ago with you if we did it then, because we just did this about a month ago and I wanted to share it. We decided to make an English barley wine using a Cavique yeast. We used the Horn and Doll from Omega. So typically, all the stuff that I just talked about, we follow the step temperatures 99.98% of the time with our higher gravity beers. But for this one, we decided to throw all that out the door and do a little R&D. So the same brewer that made the Rye Weizenbach that's here for you today, the Skipping Moose, he was kind of the point person behind this project. And we decided to just throw some Kvik yeast into a high ABV beer. And we had it fermenting at 80 to 85 degrees. It was done in 3 days. We wanted to try this out because we were seeing, we just wanted a quicker fermentation time. We wanted shorter times in our tanks so we can just keep things pumping out in our tap room and through our distribution. And we felt that this would be a little challenge for us, but to also keep within the style guidelines of the beers that we have. The desired notes that we were going for were low esters. We wanted that rich, malty, little dark fruit character, some caramel and leathery notes from this English barley wine. And our trained sensory panel of 18, we basically came up as a group that it hit about 8.33 out of 10 for our brand standard for this beer. Our quality lab, if anything is over 7.75, then it's good to go, package it, and send it off to the people. So this beer did very well in our sensory program. So we're going to keep messing around with this yeast and this type of beer to see if we can lower our fermentation time in our tanks. And so if you guys do head over to Cincinnati, it's not too far away from here. It will be on tap in about a month, and it's called One If By Land, Two If By Tree. Yeah, we thought we were pretty clever with that one.
And then last thing we want to talk about in this section is insufficient oxygen. Like we said, we needed to have extra oxygen. So the thing about insufficient oxygen, it's the absolute easiest thing to fix. So it's this one of the simplest things, but it's also one of the most harmful if you don't fix it, okay? If you don't have enough oxygen in order for you to create the cell growth you need for these larger high-gravity batches, you're going to end up with an elevated final gravity, which you don't want. You will probably have noticeable levels of diacetyl and acetaldehyde, and we know what those smell and taste like, so those are two surefire beer spoilers. Now, how do we fix that, okay? Insufficient oxygen, what do you need to do?
Well, we're going to talk about that in a second.
Well, can we talk about it now?
No.
Oh. Sorry. Hang on. I got ahead.
All right. Well, we jumped a section. So next thing is just some adaptations that we've learned from our brewing in the pro world that we would like to share with you. So just kind of modifying your normal production process to accommodate higher gravity brewing. So in this section, we will be discussing adding extra oxygen, feeding the yeast some of that awesome nutrients that you guys have been in a couple talks today about as well, I'm pretty sure. Adding some more hops, aging and conditioning that beer, and another little story about changing your mill gap settings to adjust for high gravity beer, as well as using a larger yeast starter.
Okay, can I go now?
Yes.
Okay. So adding more oxygen, that's real simple, right? Just do that. And all you really need in a normal beer, low to mid-gravity beer, I should say, is 8 to 14 parts per million of dissolved oxygen in wort for adequate fermentation. In a high gravity, you want to increase that to 15 to 18. See? Simple, right? Right? Not so simple because you're like, okay, well then, how much oxygen am I squirting in there to do that? Well, that this is going to get into a whole, you could do a whole session on exactly calculating that oxygen. What I will say is do some research. There's a lot of really good material out there on how much oxygen to apply to get these levels. But once you've figured out what you need for your low to mid gravity, once you're getting somewhere in the range of 8 to 14, luckily, 8 to 14 parts per million, that's a nice wide range. So, you know, you don't have to be super, super exact. Know that if you go about 1.5 that, you're getting into that 15 to 18 range. So, I mean, these are real wide. In a brewing situation, I mean, in a professional brewery, you guys are doing, like, gauges and testing, and you have, you know, oxygen testers that are telling you the dissolved oxygen. You guys aren't going to have all that thousands of dollars of equipment, but it's easy once you kind of figure out, you know, that if I blast the oxygen in my 5-gallon batch for 1 minute at you know, this setting on my tank, I know I'm getting this because I've done these calculations. Then you know, hey, a minute and a half, boom, I have enough for my high gravity. So I'm just saying, once you do the initial legwork of figuring it out and figuring out in your how your equipment works, then just 1.5, and then you're kind of getting into where you need. Don't go beyond that. We don't want to give it too much, because if we give it too much, we could actually cause some off flavors on its own. So why do we need more oxygen? This is the more important question. Well, the solubility of oxygen will actually decrease as the wort gravity increases. So that means as you have more sugars in that solution, more solutes, it is going to be harder to get that oxygen to dissolve into it. Okay, so you're going to need to give it more. You also need more because you're giving it more yeast cells. As we said, we have to pitch a higher pitch rate in these recipes. And why is that oxygen needed specifically for high gravity more so than others? Well, it is used, number one, to repair the damaged membranes on cells. Okay, so the three things that we're going to have a lot of in a high gravity brew is one of the thing or the things that it will fix. So these cells are going to be damaged through regular reproduction. Okay, so we need to remember that yeast cells are different than other cells. They don't reproduce by splitting, which is called mitosis. They reproduce by budding, where they actually grow another yeast cell on the side of them, and then once it's fully formed, they break off. But they leave behind these budding scars. So we need to repair all that damage that is being done, and it is helped by having more oxygen to do so. We also need to repair damage caused by desiccation. As we said, hyperosmotic stress, these higher gravity worts, are going to cause those cells to dry out. We need to keep them viable as long as we can until they finally do die. So to help them along, that desiccation will be helped by extra oxygen. And lastly, alcohol toxicity. So even though yeast is producing alcohol, large amounts of alcohol are toxic to any sort of cell out there, including yeast. Therefore, we're trying to give it as much help as it can get.
So no matter what generation of yeast that you're dealing with, you want to make sure that you're giving it sufficient nutrients, one of those being oxygen, and some other things that you can also add to your beer. With the higher ABV beers, we are really trying to ensure that we're creating a healthy environment for your yeast so it stays viable. So most yeast nutrients do contribute nitrogen. They are used to synthesize the amino acids and membrane proteins. So if you remember that, those are used when we're creating that biomass we're reproducing. These nutrients are used when they're budding or they're reproducing, as James was talking about earlier. And as you can see on the picture on the left, that is a mother cell budding out a daughter cell from a yeast. These nutrients are also used to repair the cell membranes from damage that is caused from budding. As you can see on the picture on the right, that is a mother cell with quite a few budding scars. So having that yeast nutrients is really helping build up that cell membrane. Eventually, your yeast will have too many budding scars and they won't be viable any longer and won't be able to reproduce. So by using some of these yeast nutrients, you're going to continue helping keep that yeast healthy for you and your beer. So the several commercially available products, one of them is diammonium phosphate. That's a good source of nitrogen for your yeast. There's also Fermate K that contains the DAP. There is some dead yeast in there as well as magnesium sulfate, folic acid, and a few other very scientific-sounding ingredients that I have a hard time pronouncing. You can also get GoFirm. Many of these products are derived from actual yeast, or they do contain dead yeast. Just remember to read your manufacturer's recommendation when you're using these products. You don't want to overdo it. If you have too much nutrients, you can cause other problems or off flavors in your finished beer. So one very important nutrient for yeast is zinc. zinc sulfate. This nutrient is useful for any beer because you normally don't have that in your wort. It's helpful for yeast in any of your batches from low to high gravity. Typically, this you want to add that to your chilled wort after your boil. So some of the benefits that zinc has is it does assist with your cellular growth and your viability for your yeast. It helps metabolism and fermentation rate, as well as it does aid in the flocculation for your yeast. We do have the preferred content for pitch rate for your zinc, but as well, as we've said before, make sure you're looking at your manufacturer's recommendation. There also was a zinc talk earlier today, and Kara Taylor's presentation will be available on the AHA's website. We do recommend looking at that if you wanted to dive more into zinc.
Yeah, she did a nice deep dive earlier this morning on zinc, and I highly recommend getting into that. That gives you a little bit better idea on that instead of us kind of detailing. There's a lot more to talk about with zinc. So in addition to adding nutrients, we need to add more hops. Why is that? Well, hop isomerization efficiency is actually going to be lowered in a high-gravity wort because of all these, again, the solutes in that solution. If you don't know, I hope you all know, but the isomerization is the process by which alpha acids are being converted. The alpha acids in the hops are being converted to bittering components in the boil. Okay, so it is important that we're going to give it more hops than you normally would in a low or mid-gravity beer of the same or similar bitterness. And you will always have this issue with high-gravity beers, so you want to make sure you're calculating that in. Traditionally, high-gravity beers have always been matured for some time. And now, I know what you're going to ask, and in preparing for this, I thought maybe we could come up with some surefire, okay, this is the length of time you need to do it at this temperature. You are going to find a million articles with a million different things on what to do, and then go on the forums and find a bunch of other, hey, I did it for this long and this. Okay, I have two recommendations for you. Number one, go to the brewery that you really like their high-gravity beers, okay? Go befriend one of their brewers, buy them a beer, buy her a beer, and ask them about their process. Brewers love to talk beer, and they will often be very happy to talk about, I mean, there's not some big secret in how they're doing their high-gravity aging. So talk to them. And you know, I mean, if you came up to Brittany at Madtree, I'm sure she would be happy to talk to you about it or refer you to one of the other people in the cellar that works on it and ask them. And so then glean some information from that. But you could also find out for yourself, either after you've got this information or just doing it on your own. So going back to that scientific method, so you take, you know, you take your beer, you put it in bottles for conditioning, and then you have it at a certain temperature. Record that data. What temperature is it staying at? Make sure you have a thermometer in that room and it's staying constant. Monitor it. Figure out that length of time. Okay, you left it for a month, left it for 3 weeks, 2 weeks. Record that data. Crack one. Taste it. Go through the sensory analysis. Okay, you know where you're at. Wait another week. Wait another 2 weeks. Crack one. Again, record your data, analyze, and keep repeating until you get the one you want. So then the next time you do that exact same batch, because we don't want to change a bunch of other factors, we want to produce the exact same beer again, you're going to go back and you're going to say, oh, well, I know at 3 weeks, at this temperature in the basement, it was exactly where I wanted it to be in a final beer. And so you'll be able to repeat that. Remember, I've said repeatability is the most important factor in professional brewing, and honestly, it should be in your home brewing as well. Also remember, you're not going to be able to remove fusels. So if you haven't tried to avoid making them already, you're not going to be able to remove them if you get high fusels. So you want to watch out for those higher alcohols and make sure that they don't happen in the first place. Aging will mellow out strong flavors, so you want to be very conscious of that because you may be able to mellow out some of the harsh edges that you're trying to get rid of, but at the same time, you may mellow out some of the great flavors you want to keep. So it's a balancing act, and again, record that data, figure out what your sweet spot is in time and temperature. Hop compounds. That is what causes oxidation in beer, hops. Hop compounds. So over time, because molecules are moving around in that liquid, all beer is going to oxidize if it has hop compounds in it. And that's fine. That's just what happens. But the more hop compounds you have, the faster that oxidation is going to come to fruition. So instead of doing a really big hoppy beer and then aging it for a long time, you might want to go with styles that don't have a ton of hops if you're planning on an aging schedule. Also, you don't have to do this in bottles. You can do this in a keg if you wanted to. You could age it in your fermenter if you had a fermenter with good seals on it. There's a lot of options there. Again, try things, record data, analyze, repeat. And, of course, just watch your storage temperatures, because the higher the temperature you give it, you're going to also accelerate that oxidation we talked about. So again, even if it only has a smidgen of hops in that recipe, because it's a nice big malty recipe, you're still going to get some oxidation if hops are present at all.
So one of the other adjustments you can do for high gravity brewing, we do this at Madry. We figured out that our highly kilned malt was giving off too much of a roasted character that we did not want in our high-gravity beers. We have a picture there is our Rubus Cacao. That is a chocolate porter with cocoa nibs and raspberries added to it.
Delicious.
So what we decided to do was play around with our mill gap settings. We have a four roller, but you can also do this at home as long as you trust your judgment on your gap settings for your mills. So what we do is for our higher kilned malt, like our roasted barley, our chocolates, or the caramel 120s, or a little bit lower to 80, we adjust our gap setting to be 1.85 millimeters in our lower gap one, instead of the standard that we have at Madry of 1.15 millimeters. By doing this, we've noticed that we are getting less of those highly roasted characters from those malts, and we're getting more of just a sweeter character that we were wanting originally for those beers. There obviously are some benefits and drawbacks. We have seen increased lager efficiency with these higher gravity beers. We are hitting our overall brew house efficiency pretty close to our house IPA. Our high gravity beers are hitting around like 91% efficiency, and our house IPA, we've got up to like 95. So this little bit of adjustment, we've seen a big improvement on. We're also, like I said, getting less astringent characteristics derived from the malt. However, because how we have to do this, the mill gap adjustments do take time. So we mill our base malts, about 50% of the recipe, into our grist case. Then we adjust our gap, mill the higher kilned malts, and then we go back to finish off the recipe with the base malt. So by doing that, we're not creating a homogeneous grist into our grist case, which also then carries over to the lager tun. So just make sure you keep that in mind if you decide to try this out at home. But we, like I said, we've seen a really big improvement overall. So one of the other things that you can do is just have an larger yeast starter. That will help you get the required number of cells for those higher gravity beers to achieve that higher pitch rate that we talked about earlier. You could also just buy a bunch of yeast, but that does get a little bit more expensive. Or you could buy a larger Erlenmeyer flask. Eventually, in the long run, it's going to be cheaper to go that method.
So it's pretty simple. Just get yourself a big old 5-liter Erlenmeyer. And you do also want to use a higher quality stir plate in that situation. So some of the disadvantages are a big old 5-liter Erlenmeyer is a little bit hard to handle when it's full. You just need to be a little more careful. You don't want to drop and break glass in your kitchen or wherever you're working. But once you get used to it, a decanting is not that much harder than using a 1-liter or a 2-liter. Also, you need to have a quality stir plate. You know, I know some people have made their own stir plate at home. There's kits and directions online on how to do that. There's some cheap ones available. I will tell you this. I had one that was a cheapie, and it was working just fine for me. And I got a 5-liter, and I put it on it, and it just was not a strong box that it was in, and it pushed down, and it caused the mechanism inside to get caught. And that heavy weight of that extra liquid in on top of it just... it just didn't turn. So you need to have a nice quality stir plate. You might even need to have a larger stir bar to really get that going. Not necessarily, but you might if you find you're not getting the movement you want out of it.
So another method to get a larger yeast starter, you could, instead of buying a bigger flask and a better stir plate, you could brew a mid-gravity beer and then repitch the yeast that you created onto that. This is a much cheaper method than buying more yeast or more equipment, and you could get a substantial amount of more output of your yeast cells. You want to make sure that if you do go this route, that you match your yeast for both recipes that you're making. It does need to work with both styles of the beers that you're brewing. Also make sure that if you are repitching yeast, that you keep your you don't let your generations of your repitch yeast get too high if you do multiple generation pitches.
So if you are lucky enough to be one of those folks who has a conical fermenter, her husband Adam has a conical. That's why actually I like brewing at their house better, because it's A, it's all their equipment. I don't have to clean up as much, but B, I love using that conical because it's so much easier. It's well worth the investment. I'm convinced I'm going to buy one eventually. And Mary Beth's out of the room, so I can say that. But I highly recommend dumping all the yeast that is at the bottom of that conical after 48 hours, okay? That's because at that point, at 48 hours in, it's just been producing biomass. So those are all the dead yeast cells that are covered in the budding scars, and they've just dropped. So so you don't risk autolysis and those rupturing and leaking stuff you don't want at 48 hours. Just go ahead and figure what you got at the bottom there and do a dump. And then as soon as you start seeing liquid, you know, stop it and you're good. You're going to lose a little bit of liquid, but you're going to get rid of all those dead cells. All the rest of the yeast that it's created is bouncing around in that solution. So it'll be totally fine. A quick little story. 2019, we won a ton of grain at our local homebrew competition in the raffle. Actually, a friend of ours who doesn't brew won it. And so we had to try to figure out how to use up all this grain because they already had a ton of grain. I had grain at home, and so we didn't know what to do with this. So we got together and decided to do a high-gravity batch. So then we were doing our, you know, recipes and trying to figure it out. And Brittany and I realized that in order to have enough yeast cells to pitch for this big batch, we needed a lot of yeast packets, and we were not going to spend the money on that. So we made a brown ale, and it was delicious, and we did it in the same conical. That's actually the same one you guys at home, right? Spike? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they have a Spike conical. We did it in the conical, and as soon as that beer was ready, we timed it so it would be the same day we brewed the barley wine. We racked the brown off into a keg and left the yeast at the bottom that was just chilling because it had been done. And this is, again, we did pull the 48 and dump the first 48, but it was at the end of the 7 days with that brown, we had a ton of yeast in the bottom of that conical. So we racked it off, and then we pumped in that barley wine that same day. And man, did we have enough yeast. We cleaned up, and we went to go play some cards and hang out and play some games, and a little later, I was like, uh-oh, is one of the dogs getting into something, or is there something leaking? Because I hear something bubbling or water, and I go in the room, and that thing is just blowing off, you know, into the bucket. And I was like, holy cow, and this is only several hours later. It finished at like 11 point, or not finished, but it got to our target, which is around 11.8, in just around 2 days. Because it had just enough yeast. I mean, it was just so perfect. And then I think it was fully done. He's got one of those tilt hydrometers. I believe Adam said it was fully done for three. I mean, we let it go a whole seven just to make sure everything was cleaned up. We got our diacetyl rest and all that. We made sure it was cleaned up. But that thing was done so fast. We had so much good yeast. And that barley wine came out amazing. So it's a real easy way to do it if you want to do one batch and repitch that yeast.
All right, to wrap it up for you guys, we have our related sources here posted for you. You can access these links from the PDF on the conference website. There are a ton of other great resources that you can find on the American Homebrewers Association website, which also does have great articles on high gravity brewing and 11 different recipes.
So on the AHA sister website, you can purchase brewers publication books. And one of the ones that we would both recommend is called Yeast, The Practical Guide to Beer Fermentation. And that's written by Chris White and Jamil. That was actually our textbook in school, in our ingredients class when we went to brewing school. And if you really, really want to understand yeast and get into more of the details that we've been talking about and really do a deep dive, I highly recommend that book. It is like the Bible on yeast. Also, tomorrow, I think at 12:30-ish or something, Chris White, who's one of the main authors of the book, is going to be signing it somewhere here. So look in your program for this conference so you can go meet him and buy the book and have it signed.
Another book that we recommend is Barley Wine by Fall Allen and Dick Cantwell. This covers the history of the barley wine style, brewing techniques, and also includes some recipes for barley wines.
And then lastly, we were encouraging you to consider Plato instead of specific gravity. Well, we gave you a link to a really nice specific gravity Plato conversion tool that we use all the time. When we're doing stuff. A lot of times, Brittany's like bringing ideas from work, and they're all on Plato, and Adam and I are kind of still in specific gravity with the homebrew stuff, and I kind of bounce between the two. My brain is like always a mess, so I need that tool.
All right, so we wanted to wrap it up with this slide. It was something that one of our instructors in brewing school really challenged us with. So as we know, sometimes folks approach homebrewing as a casual hobby. But after a long week of dealing with technical and detailed stuff at their jobs, they, who are clearly not any of you in this room, think that that will be an easy hobby that they can relax and do. As you all know, that is not that hobby, and we all want to make good beer.
So this is what Austin told us in our class. High quality beer is made intentionally. When you write a beer recipe and plan a fermentation, lagering, and aging schedule, you can imagine how every single ingredient and every step of your process shows itself in that finished product. You must consider every single step with cold, dispassionate logic. There is a way to make nearly any beer you can imagine, but there are far more ways to miss the mark. Constantly be asking yourself, does this make sense? And that was Austin Zanella, who is the innovation coordinator at Rheingeist Brewery in Cincinnati.
We'd like to thank Austin. He, like we said, he was our instructor, specifically for advanced brewing at Cincinnati State. His lecture that he gave in our class inspired part of this lecture that we shared with you today. We took some of those ideas, and after over the years of brewing professionally and working in the field and at home, we continue to learn, and we wanted to share those ideas with you all today.
And hopefully we've made them accessible to home brewing. So
thank you, guys. If you have any questions afterwards, there's our contact information. So please reach out. We're always happy to help you. And we also do have some beer at the Grain Works booth at the kickoff party tonight. You can find us there as well.
Yes, come on, see us. If you don't get a chance to ask us questions now, you can grab us at the booth at the kickoff party. If you want to ask some questions, go ahead and step up to the mic.
Two clarification questions. One, you talked about the crush setting on your mill for the grain.
Mm-hmm.
For the high kiln malts, is it a smaller crush or a wider crush?
Good question. So for the highly kilned malts, it's a wider crush. Our standard rate for our base malt is 1.15 millimeters, sorry. And then for the highly kilned malts, we enlarge it to 1.85.
Okay. And the second clarification was on adding oxygen or adding your other adjuncts later during fermentation and maybe adding oxygen with that. So you talked about oxygen initially.
Oxygen initially, not adding it later in the fermentation. Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was not clear on that. Yeah. But the adding the adjuncts later is allowing some of those solutes to be dissolved or eaten by the yeast and then making more room for more solutes, but keeping that hyperosmotic stress low.
Hi. So it seems like there's a bit of controversy as to the advisability of pitching onto a yeast cake, such as you suggested. Depending on who you talk to, some people have said that essentially the absence of a lag phase, such as you described, is a bad thing. It sounds, based on your anecdote, that you do not subscribe to that way of looking at things, but I guess I'm just curious to get your response to those who say, using a small batch and then using the entire yeast cake might be considered over-pitching.
And you got to watch it because you could potentially create too much yeast. But like I said, we're dropping that first 48, so we're getting rid of everything that's dead. So you don't got to worry about the autolysis aspect. And we probably did have more yeast than we needed. But we had enough yeast. experiment, you know. But as far as how professionals do it, you guys reuse yeast all the time, and I don't know if you guys do cone to cone. Do you do cone to cone?
Yes, so we do cone to cone, but we also measure because we know what our yeast is that day that we're pitching, and
right.
We measure it by gallons into our tanks.
So if you don't know, cone to cone, what that would be is you are actually reusing yeast and from one batch to another, and you're transferring it from one fermenter to another into another beer and reusing that. There are breweries that have great labs like Madtree that can check viability, measure how much you have, figure out based on samples how many cells that they're actually pitching so they have exact amounts. There are other breweries that are smaller that do cone to cone and pitching on top of yeast that's already been used in successive generations that aren't doing those details. Again, it's about checking your data, looking at your results, looking for repeatability. These are techniques that are used all the time. I mean, pitching on top of used yeast is happening all the time in professional brewing. What you won't have at home is a lab to check all those details. So again, you may have to watch those details, collect some data, or heck, I mean, if you know you're getting like the same thing, you're always doing we did that brown ale, and you always did that brown ale, and then you're always going to throw it on a barley wine. If you got a friend who works at a brewery, take a sample down the lab, and they could tell you how many cells you got that are viable in that, you know.
But in your experience, if you were to say brew on a 5% at the homebrew scale, and then rack a 10% on top, you have not experienced any issues with that in
terms
of
all.
Over-pitching.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No, and we've done it several times. It works great.
I've had a question for a couple of years I just can't seem to find the answer to. You know, as gravity gets up to a point, honey, as an example, is too high a gravity to ferment. But you start adding water, it'll start fermenting. So where's the range to where the yeast will actually start to propagate and do their thing?
Sorry. With using just honey?
Well, no. Well, say for instance, malt or whatever number of sugars. What gravity at the point where the yeast just won't ferment because it's just too high a gravity?
Oh, you're what is the level that the wort is just too high that the yeast just can't even get started?
Yes.
Oh, that's an interesting question.
Okay, like I said, it's been a couple of years and I can't find the answer.
Yeah. Have you talked to any of the yeast manufacturers?
No, I have not.
That would, that's a great, yes, because they would probably know if anybody's going to know.
I'll run downstairs and ask them.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Or they can put you in touch with their tech folks. If you know, if the folks who are here don't know, they could put you in touch with their tech folks who may have that answer for you. Also, our emails are up there. If you wanted to email us, if you didn't get an answer at the conference, email us and we could start asking around the industry. Okay. I'm sure through MBAA or our local brewing groups. Brittany is also the president of our local Pink Boots Society. So she knows like all the brewers, and she organizes like all our local rubber boots, which is a gathering of all the breweries in town monthly to just hang out and talk stuff. So she knows everybody in town between all the local contacts, some of the MBA contacts I have. I'm sure we can find you an answer.
Okay. If I find out, I'll send you an email and let you know.
Please do. It's Yeah. And if you have the answer, please do.
Yeah, it's been a couple of years. I can't find the answer. Thank you.
Thank you.
You had touched a little bit on using the Kvike yeasts here. If using the Kvike yeast, would your processes with oxygenation and yeast nutrients change at all versus a traditional yeast?
So since it was a high-gravity beer, we did up the oxygen content. So we had it at 18 to 21 ppm for our oxygen, where usually we try to hit between 11 and 14. So that was increased. And then the yeast nutrients, we did add a little bit extra more. We use a commercial yeast nutrients, but we did add a little bit more.
Thank you. Hi. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit on the grain-to-water ratio in terms of the impact on efficiency and if and how you might adjust that for high-gravity brewing. I've also wondered why it might be that a specific grain-to-water ratio is more efficient.
So you're asking if we increase our grist-to-liquor ratio with high-gravity beer?
Sure.
Okay. So there are two different methods that you can do for high-gravity beer. You can increase it or you could decrease it. What I've always done as a brewer is I've always increased my grist-to-liquor ratio. Usually it's about 1.35 Yes, 1.35. If it's higher gravity, I increase it to 1.55.
Okay, and why do you go higher?
Just because of the increased malt bill, I want to make sure that everything is soaked correctly and that I'm not leaving any sugars behind in that bigger bill.
Okay. So it's like a contact area kind of thing?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey, Goose.
Hey, James. How you doing?
Good.
Could you clarify this? You know I was a pro for a while, so adding extra oxygen to a high-gravity beer, I've always lived by the mantra and heard by the mantra that you can add extra O2 to a fermenting beer up to 24 hours after your initial pitch of yeast. Can you dispel that myth?
And I definitely want her to answer. I just want to throw one little thing at this, but you have far more professional brewing experience than I do. But I'll just say that remember that yeast growth curve. You know, the yeast is still creating biomass and therefore consuming oxygen. It is not getting into fermentation, and it is still able to be processing that oxygen, okay, for that first 40 hours, okay? So the key to making sure you don't oxidize your beer accidentally is you want to make sure that oxygen gets utilized. So you don't want to pitch any oxygen or add any oxygen after that yeast has stopped creating biomass and is started in the fermentation phase. Because at that point, the reason yeast ferments is it is going from aerobic respiration, otherwise known as creating more biomass multiplying, duplicating, to anaerobic fermentation. It is that lack of oxygen that it causes to change the Krebs cycle, if you want to dig into biology, change that Krebs cycle and start producing alcohol and CO2. That's what's happening after all that oxygen is gone. So if you're going to add more, you want to add it before that oxygen is gone because it's already got oxygen.
Right.
And now I would say because we know the typical life cycle is about 40 hours. At 24, you should be safe. Again, these are data points. You know what I mean? Since you're not a brewery that can pull a sample off your sample port and know what the, you know, dissolved oxygen in it is and where you're at, you know, you don't have those labs to figure that out. The oxidometer, I don't know, what is that? Dissolved oxygen machine? You don't have that thing. Sorry, you know all these terms. You don't have the ability to figure that out. So I would just say try to stay within safety guidelines that, as far as within understanding the science behind it. I think 24 hours should be fine. I think under 40 hours you should be fine, but lean earlier than later. But please, what would you do? You guys add more later than initially?
No, we do not. We just add when we're pitching into the fermenter.
And would
but
you?
But he covered exactly what I would say. So,
okay.
Yes.
Cool. Thanks.
Thanks, Goose. We got time for these two more, and then we got to wrap it up.
What's your experience with bottle conditioning and trying to get the right carbonation level? It's something I find it's always hard with bottle conditioning, stressing it out. Do you do additional pitch or?
Okay, so I'm going to be a terrible person because I absolutely hate doing bottle conditioning to create carbonation. As soon as I got myself the kegerator and in kegs and started kegging things, I was like, I am done with bottles forever. I had so many hit or misses as a home brewer with bottles, and it's just such a crapshoot. There's so many factors that go into it, and I hated cracking these beers that I spent all this money and time on, and they just were flat or they were overcarbed, and I just said, you know, screw this. I can do this with a nice beer gun. And you guys have a beer gun at home too, and that's just how we, you know, build our bottles for competition or to give to friends, you know. And I just stay away from doing it. So I am the worst person to ask. Did you ever, before you guys got a beer gun, did you guys ever do the thing in the bottle at home?
Yeah, I'm sorry. We've never bottle conditioned, but I'd be more than happy to find that answer for you.
Yeah. Are they doing it professionally often with these higher gravity beers, or you think it's still...
I know in Europe there is a lot of that, but again, remember we talked about in professional brewing, it's about repeatability. These are things they've been doing for hundreds of years, so they have these down. I don't know in America how many breweries are doing a lot of that condition. I know there are some because they talk about, hey, you need to store this beer before you crack it for X number of time from this date, but I don't know that there's a lot of breweries doing it because it's just then it becomes a crapshoot, and you don't want a bad product.
Yeah, I'll send an email.
Please, yes.
Yeah,
thank you.
I just wanted to ask you, what's your opinion of multiple pitches of yeast early in the fermentation process? And just this comes from a practical standpoint where, in many cases, I don't have enough time to build a starter. So we'll add some dry yeast, oxygenate, spin for 24 to 48 hours, and then pitch the second starter.
Oh, wait. So build a starter and then... Pitch another starter. Clarify.
Pitch the dry yeast in the first at when you're completing the beer, pitch the dry yeast. Build the second pitch for 24 to 48 hours, and then pitch before fermentation has really started.
I see what you're saying. Yeah. So you ran out of time. You forgot to make a starter,
exactly.
But you don't want the wort just to sit there. So you throw in some dry yeast. You let it get started. And then, hey, you know, 24, 48 hours, I'm building my starter, you know, while we're waiting and
exactly.
Then throw it in. Again, I think going back to the question Goose had, you just want to make sure from that first pitch of your initial yeast that you threw in, I think that 40-hour window would be your longest. And you want to be as far away from the end of that as possible. So 24 hours, maybe. But I don't know that I would wait for 48 to throw in more oxygenated wort starter. You know, if you threw in more not, you know, if you knew it was no oxygen left in there, you know. But, you know, if I really needed it, you'd take a shot. I don't know. What do you think?
I wouldn't recommend it as a, standard practice, but I understand time constraints. And it sounds like what you're doing is essentially creating kind of like a prop batch, and then you're pitching more yeast into it later. As long as you keep it within that, while the oxygen is coming out of the yeast, then I think that's okay. But
okay.
Again, not don't do that all the time.
Last question.
You were talking a lot about diacetyl. Have you ever considered using this enzyme I recently learned about, this ILDC? And the other question is, you do your first batch. If you do a first running and use that first running as your hot liquor for your second batch, that's probably not practical with your vessels on a professional level.
Well, if there's only so much that you can gain sugar into your wort, there is a point where it's not going to be able to extract any more out of it. So that's why we recommended mashing in again with fresh water. As far as the diacetyl question that you have, there are a couple of commercially diacetyl agents out there that help with that. We do use that at Matry. We have there's a special yeast that's being created that's diacetyl-free yeast. So we use that in our fruited beers or our very heavily hopped beers. There's also an enzyme out there as well, too. So it's used, and I recommend it. We've seen some really good results from using that.
I know I got into a conversation with somebody online a few years back while we were still in school, and I posed this question to one of our professors about that same thing, about doing a double batch where you're using the first runnings as your basically your hot liquor and your second one. You know, yes, you can do that. And somebody online said, hey, I'm a professional brewer. We do this, and it works. But you also have to remember there is a theoretical limit to how much you can extract. And if you have a high concentration already in that liquid, it is going to have less efficiency pulling out of it. So I would say you're much better off doing like the double mashing where you pull the first runnings from two different things of grain. Now, then you're like, well, I'm leaving a lot of sugar on the table. That's why I said, hey, check the Partagile one out and maybe do a second. So it becomes a triple batch day, but you get two beers out of it. Thank you very much, guys. Our email addresses are up here. If you guys want to grab one of my cards, I have my cards here if you want to grab that instead. Come see us over the kickoff party at the Grainworks booth and have some more Grainworks.